From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
1, 2, 3. Oh, the shark, babe, has such deep dip.
On today's Fresh Air, the music of Bobby Darin. A new movie about his life, Beyond the Sea, opens next week. First, we'll hear from Kevin Spacey, who plays Darin in the film. He also produced and directed the film, and he sings Darin's songs. He's received a Golden Globe nomination for his role. Also, we listened to a 1996 interview with Darin's producer and friend, the late Nick Vinay. They met as teenagers when they broke into music in New York's Brill Building, where the two shared an office and a broom closet. They remained close until Darin's death in 1973. The music of Bobby Darin coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has been visiting troops in Iraq. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports from Baghdad.
Secretary Rumsfeld began his whistle-stop tour in Mosul, landing in the pre-dawn darkness. He visited with troops at a combat surgical hospital where many victims of Tuesday's bombing were treated. He then went on to Tikrit, Fallujah, and Baghdad. The aim of the Christmas Eve visit was to provide a morale boost to the troops, but he referred repeatedly to the difficulties in combating the insurgency here, saying in one statement that, quote, "I don't want in any way to paint a picture that's pretty." His ultimate message, though, was clear.
We see this insurgency pressing on and on, month after month. There is no doubt in my mind but that this is achievable.
Rumsfeld was greeted warmly at each stop. He has come under fire, though, recently for what his critics say is his lack of compassion. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
Police cars and ambulances converged on an upscale Baghdad neighborhood today where a massive explosion killed at least one person and injured more than a dozen. Iraqi police say the blast was caused by explosives wired to a gas tanker truck. The tanker had been parked near the Libyan and Moroccan embassies. Doctors at a Baghdad hospital say most of the wounded suffered second-degree burns. No one at the embassies was hurt. The attack came just hours after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld left the capital. Britain has now joined the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in freezing the funds of Saeed al-Faqi, a man the United Nations has linked to al-Qaeda. Larry Miller reports from London.
Britain's Treasury has ordered financial institutions in the country to immediately freeze the assets of both Saeed al-Faqi and the organization he heads, the London-based Movement for Islamic Reform in Arabia. The U.S. alleges that al-Faqi, a Saudi, has provided material support to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Earlier this week, in a BBC interview, al-Faqi denied he was linked to al-Qaeda, and he has not been arrested by British police. The group's website says it seeks freedom of expression and assembly in Saudi Arabia and the abolition of the Saudi secret police. It claims it uses peaceful means to achieve its goals. However, the UN Security Council agreed with the U.S. position and listed him as an associate of al-Qaeda. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
The probe of the bombing at the U.S. base near Mosul will be led by a veteran Army investigator. Military officials say Brigadier General Richard Formica will head the team that will try to find out how a suicide bomber was able to get onto the base and blow himself up in a crowded mess tent. Officials have said they believe the bomber was wearing an Iraqi military uniform. Formica also led the Army's investigation into the abuse of inmates at Abu Ghraib prison. This is NPR News. The only survivor of a fishing boat disaster off New England is planning to sue the federal government and the owners of the boat. Five fishermen are missing and presumed drowned. Dan Tridle reports from member station WCAI.
The vessel Northern Edge capsized and sank off Nantucket Island in stormy weather on Monday. Fisherman Pedro Furtado was rescued by another boat, but his five crewmates were lost at sea. Furtado's attorney says she'll file two lawsuits, one against the vessel's owner for its alleged lack of seaworthiness, and another against the U.S. government, claiming that fishing restrictions put pressure on the crew to fish in bad weather. The tragedy has prompted Massachusetts Senators Edward Kennedy and John Kerry to call for a review of the federal rules. They were put in place in the early 1990s to prevent overfishing and have been highly controversial. Aircraft mechanical problems and bad weather delayed the Coast Guard's response to this week's incident. Coast Guard officials say that despite the problems, they're confident they did all they could. For NPR News, I'm Dan Tridle in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Highway workers in the Midwest are gradually reopening some of the roads that were blocked by yesterday's massive snowstorm, but in some places that also means removing hundreds of abandoned vehicles. Temperatures dropped below freezing in many areas, making the cleared highways dangerously slick. In western Indiana, workers reopened a portion of Interstate 64, where more than 100 stranded travelers had to be rescued from their snowbound vehicles yesterday. Some churches in Indiana canceled Christmas services to keep people from driving. Police in many areas are telling drivers to stay home unless their travel represents a life-threatening emergency. In Ohio, about 275,000 homes remain without electricity. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop celebrates the season, offering CD compilations of songs and artists heard on NPR programming. Our complete collection is available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. With the release of Kevin Spacey's new movie about Bobby Darin, plus a new CD and DVD featuring some Darin rarities, this is a good time to listen to Darin's music. He was one of the most sophisticated and jazz-inspired pop stars of the 1960s. His hits included Dream Lover, Mac the Knife, Beyond the Sea, and If I Were a Carpenter. A little later, we'll hear an interview with the late Nick Vanney, who was Darin's friend and producer. First, Kevin Spacey talks about his new movie, Beyond the Sea. A movie about Darin's life had been in the works for years. Spacey auditioned for the role of Darin in 1999 when he was 40, but was told he was too old for the part. He was already 3 years older than Darin was when he died of heart failure in 1973. Spacey wanted to portray Darin so badly he ended up buying the film rights to his story, then producing, directing, and starring in the film. He even did the singing himself. Here's his version of one of Darin's biggest hits.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on a high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing.
Kevin Spacey from the soundtrack of Beyond the Sea. He's performing Darin tunes in a series of nightclub performances leading up to the opening of the film. Shortly before the start of the tour, he spoke with Terry. He told her that to prepare for the role, he worked with music producer Phil Ramone, studying Darin's TV shows and records in an attempt to replicate his voice and movements.
At a certain point, I stopped all that because I really didn't want to feel saddled by doing an out-and-out imitation of him. But I had to have his energy and his style and his attack. And the rest of it had to come from me, or both Ramone and Kellaway and myself felt it would probably end up being hollow. So, you know, Ramone talks about a moment in the process, and I don't know when this was, where he says, you stopped trying to do an imitation of Bobby Darin, and that I started to use my own instincts as a performer, and yet I had, you know, accumulated so much of Bobby, I'd watched so much of him that it was kind of almost under my skin. And so it was a version of Bobby. And I want to make it very clear to anyone who goes and sees the film or gets the album, you know, to misquote Senator Benson, I'm no Bobby Darin. The truth is that this was a remarkable artist for whom nobody gets that close. You know, we've tried to honor him. We've tried to do the best job that we could. But if people haven't had a chance to see Bobby Darin, I encourage them to go out and get his work.
What was your introduction to his music?
My mother. My mother was absolutely crazy about Bobby Darin, and I grew up in a house where his records were playing all the time, Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, the great big bands. So I just grew up with that kind of brassy sound. And so by the time I was in my teenage years, I thought he was the greatest thing that, you know, ever walked the face of the earth.
What are some of the things you learned about your voice by talking to everybody who'd worked with Darren who was still around, and by studying him and then, you know, recording his songs for your movie?
Well, a lot of it, you know, when you go into a studio like Abbey Road and you've got, we had 12 days to lay down all the tracks that we did. And there's a lot of tracks that we laid down that didn't end up in the film or on the album. So there could be a follow-up. I think it's an enormous amount of it is the energy and the breath control that it takes to get through some of these numbers. And a lot of it's pitch. You know, you sometimes you hear it in your own head in a slightly different way than it comes out. And I learned a great deal from Phil Ramone about what he used to like to call getting in the pocket of the music and getting in the pocket with the band. You know, we recorded all these live with the band. I didn't do my vocals later. We did them together. I felt I was tested. It's very tough to go through 12 days where you're, you know, doing two sessions a day and you're laying down three or four songs, or in some cases five songs a session. That's a lot of singing to do every single day. And, you know, although the tour is going to test me as well, I at least don't have a lot of multiple nights. You know, I'm going to get some downtime because I've never done it. And I think that that's one of the things you have to always think about is, when do you sing this song? When do you throw in a ballad? When do you give yourself a little, you know, talk to rest your voice? This is what singers who do this for a living are always concentrating and focusing on. And I think the other big thing that I learned was, if you don't hear yourself back, if you don't have a good enough sound system, good enough wedges, an ability to actually hear how you sound with that band, you can go off key and off pitch very easily. It's a sort of remarkable thing, both for actors and for singers, is this sense of being able to actually hear yourself so you know how much energy you have to give.
I want to play a song that you sing on the soundtrack, and in the movie this happens. This is sung toward the very end of the film. It's called The Curtain Falls. And it's a song that I think even a lot of Bobby Darin fans wouldn't know. His recording of it is featured on a new CD, DVD, which is called Aces Back to Back. Tell me how you became familiar with this song and about learning how to sing it. I think you do it well.
Well, thank you. It's a song that Bobby recorded actually on a live album at the Flamingo. And I think it was taped in 1962. And it was written specially for Bobby. The lyrics were changed. It used to be an old, perhaps Bob DeHope number, which is what I refer to it as in the film. And Bobby was leaving nightclubs for a while. You know, he and Sandy had a baby, and I think he was going to take time off from going on the road as much as he was during that period. And it was his sort of swan song to nightclubs after having lived in them for many, many years. And I just think it's one of the great show business songs, and it also just speaks enormously of Bobby personally.
Okay, so this is Kevin Spacey from the soundtrack of Beyond the Sea, Kevin Spacey's new movie about Bobby Darin.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this bit, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment.
That's Kevin Spacey.
See, that's exactly what I like, you know.
Yeah. That's Kevin Spacey from the soundtrack of his new movie, Beyond the Sea, in which he stars as Bobby Darin. And Spacey not only stars in it, he co-wrote, directed it, and co-produced it as well. Okay, so here's one of the ironies. You tried to get the part starring as Bobby Darin back in the late 80s. you don't get the part. You're not well known then. And by the time you buy the rights and actually make the movie, you're older than Bobby Darin was when he died. And
yeah.
And this is a movie that spans his life. I mean, obviously, you'd never be playing the child Bobby Darin, but you know, you do look old for the young Bobby Darin, who was starting his career. So, do you want to talk about how you get around that in the movie?
Well, I was never setting out to tell a linear a biopic, and I always knew that, and I always thought that the issue of age was a minor one. But I began to read.
Why did you think it was a minor one? For a lot of people, it would be a major one.
Because I'm warping time in this film, because mm-hmm. I'm not trying to play Bobby Darin at 17 years old. And because ultimately, you know, the movie is a fantasy. It's not a straight biopic. And I felt that if I could address the issue, as I do in the beginning of the film, you know, maybe all those people that have, you know, hung their hat on that particular piece of criticism would relax because they realize that I know it too, but we're going to break all the rules. And maybe it's brash, but that's what Bobby Darin was.
So the way you get around it, the framing device, is that Bobby Darin is making a movie about his life, and people are saying, Bobby, you're too old to play yourself.
Well, and I wrote a scene with a reporter actually saying that, mm-hmm. You know, he's too old to play this part, because sometimes the best way to, you know, sort of knock something out is to just identify the elephant in the room, and I'm pleased that that seems to be what's happening.
So once you bought the rights to the movie, you started meeting with people who knew Bobby Darin well, including his son, Dodd Darin, who probably didn't know Bobby Darin as well as he would have liked, in part because Darin, you know, died at the age of 37. What are some of the most interesting things that you learned that you didn't already know about by talking to people who knew him well?
I think I probably have come away with an admiration for how determined Bobby was to give the best performance that he could give on any given night, no matter how sick he was. Bobby contracted rheumatic fever when he was 8, and it ravaged him until he was 12. And he really wasn't supposed to live past the age of 15. But he had a remarkable family around him who supported him, who nurtured him and took care of him. And I think his will to live was stronger than the disease for, 37 years.
There are scenes in the movie where you're performing, but off stage there's oxygen waiting for you.
Well, and that's
because
absolutely
of the heart
accurate.
Trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate to what Bobby's experience was. I mean, when I would, you know, I'll look at performances of Bobby's, for example, his last television special, and, you know, watch it. It's just incredible. You wouldn't know the guy had a hangnail. And then you hear the stories of what was actually happening that day, where he was lying backstage for an hour and a half trying to get his energy back, taking oxygen. You see him in performances shaking his hands, and you think, oh, he's just doing a kind of rhythm thing. But in fact, he was trying to get the blood flowing into his arms. That continually stuns me. That he pushed himself to such a degree where he probably could have had an easier life knowing what he was facing. But he chose to walk on the edge, and obviously he felt that that's where life really was.
Bobby Darin sometimes did impressions in his act.
Yes, he did.
And you're very good at that yourself. So is that something that you particularly like about him? And
Well, I'm going to do a little bit of that on the road. He did really great impressions. And in fact, he did impressions that nobody else did. He did Jimmy Stewart and Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin and Cagney and a whole bunch of the greats. But he did Robert Mitchum's face. And it's one of the funniest things you've ever seen because he literally becomes Robert Mitchum, but he can't do Robert Mitchum's voice. So it's the funniest impression because he just looks like him. He gets applause, and then he says, well, Robert doesn't have too much to say because he couldn't do the impression. He did great voices. You know, there's a terrific I just spent a couple of weeks with Steve Blauner putting together for the Museum of Television and Radio 75 minutes of our favorite moments of Bobby Darin on television. And there's a tremendous number of skits that he did with, Bob Hope. With Jimmy Durante. He actually imitates Jimmy Durante with Jimmy Durante. It's an absolutely hysterical piece. And people, by the way, can go and see this because the Museum of Television and Radio in New York and Los Angeles are running this for the next couple of months. And I was just looking at it, and I just remarked, It's like I hadn't watched it in a while, and I just forgot how funny he was. He had incredible timing. And he was one of those kids who could pick up voices very quickly, and I just happened to be the same. I grew up kind of making funny voices and loving to imitate people, and now, of course, I love being able to do it when I work with people, and you know, you sort of try to get them down when you're working with them.
So when you're going to be on stage in your club act doing impressions, will you be doing your impressions of Jimmy Durante or whoever, or will you be doing your impression of Bobby Darin doing an impression of
Jimmy Durante? Impressions as a way to talk about the way Bobby did impressions, and I'll do a few of the ones that he did, but I'll do more of the ones that I do, because I can't do Bobby's act. I have to do my own. So, but it has the same sort of flavor, and I'm actually going to do a number that Bobby used to do, and he did a lot of impressions in this number. So I'm sort of updating it and adapting it for now.
What song is that?
It's One for the Road.
Gee, I wouldn't think of a ballad like that as being the place for impressions.
It's hysterical. It really is a very, very funny piece.
Who are you going to do in it?
I'll do a lot of people in it. I'll do some of his, you know, Jimmy Stewart and Jerry Lewis, but I'll throw in a Walken and a Carson and
that's great.
Just have a good time with it.
That's great. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
Kevin Spacey speaking to Terry Gross. He plays Bobby Darin in the new film Beyond the Sea, which hits theaters around the country next week. More about Bobby Darin after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today we're celebrating the music of Bobby Darin. The new film about Darin, Beyond the Sea, opens next week. And the new CD and DVD collection of rare performances, called Aces Back to Back, has just been released. Nick Vanney was one of Darin's closest friends and musical collaborators. They met as teenagers when they were first trying to make it in the music business. Vanney produced many of Darin's records. The list of other performers Vanney discovered or produced includes the Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Gene Vincent, Glenn Campbell, and Sam Cooke. Vanney died in 1998. 2 years earlier, Terry spoke with him after Vanney had co-produced a Bobby Darin box set. They started with Darin's first big hit, Splish Splash, recorded in 1958.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Yeah! Rubbed up, just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, put my feet on. Around me and I opened the door, and in a splish splash I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splash.
Nick Vanney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Do you know the story behind why and how Bobby Darin recorded this song?
Well, Bobby wanted to be a crooner. He wanted to be a pop singer, but he knew he had to do certain things to get on the charts and sell records. And this was his way of taking a shot at it to at least get some fame going so he could move into where he eventually made it. And this was worked out. He knew what he was doing when he made this record.
You know, it's I'd be lying if I said it's a favorite of mine. I think his rhythm in it is really great, but it's really a dumb song. And I was thinking when I was listening back to it, who foisted this song about on him when I realized he wrote it?
He wrote it. He wrote it. He was inspired by a title that a disc jockey's mother gave him. And he always said he wrote the song in 10 minutes, but he was saying that because the song shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes. He worked very hard on this song. He just put everything in it he thought would make it a hit.
How did you meet Bobby Darin?
We were both in our teens, I guess, and we were working at the Brill Building in New York. The Brill Building was the music mecca of pop music, I guess, at that time. And it was centrally located, and we met a lot of people, like Burt Bacharach had an office there, Lee Bernstolar had an office there, and Darren and I rented a broom closet and converted it into an office. And we just wanted a place to put our names on the door. And he wrote songs, and I tried to put records together. The word producer was not being used at that time. And we actually met in the elevator at the Brill Building and several times, and we ate in the same restaurant around the corner. And we just became friends, and a group of us, really. And we started hanging out and using the broom closet as a place to meet. And we kept the piano in there and a place to write and play demos.
Now, I want to play the demo of another early hit that he had, Dream Lover. And, wow, this demo is great. His singing on it is so good, and it's much more stripped down. It's very stripped down, so it's different from the very produced hit recording of this song. Now, tell me the story behind this demo.
Well, he felt that if the song didn't make it with people, if they really didn't get the message with just him and a guitar. By the way, the guitarist is Fred Neil. At that time, Fred had written a song called Candyman for Roy Orbison, and he also wrote Everybody's Talking for the Schlesinger film Midnight Cowboy. He wanted to try something which wasn't being done at that time. Everything was very, and that period of time, everything was cute and pretty. And he wanted to do something that was not cute, not pretty, but worked on another level. And he tried it with just the guitar to see how it would affect people. And it affected everyone. And he knew he had a song that would possibly transcend a certain amount of time. And he made the demo at the session with just Fred playing the guitar. And then later on, everybody asked him to add more. And he did. And he went on. And, of course, it was a hit. Either version will make it for me, too. But that version's real special because it's just Bobby and the guitar, and he sings it as well as he sang anything else.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, 'cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Bobby Darin recorded in 1959. We're listening to Terry's 1996 conversation with the late Nick Vinay. We'll hear more about Darin in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
And feel you near as I grow old, 'cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest, by photographer James Balog, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Purple Book 2005 Edition, The Definitive Guide to Exceptional Online Shopping, by Hilary Mendelson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue Terry's conversation with Bobby Darin's close friend and producer, Nick Vinay. A new movie about Bobby Darin, starring Kevin Spacey, premieres next week. Here's Spacey from the soundtrack.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're listening to the music of Bobby Darin. The film about Darin, Beyond the Sea, hits theaters around the country next week. And Aces Back to Back, a CD and DVD collection of rare performances, has just been released. Here's a track from the CD of Darin performing the song Moon River.
Moon River, wider than a mile. You know I'm crossing you in style someday. You dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I am going your way. Two drifters off to see the world. There is such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, my huckleberry.
Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with Bobby Darin's friend and producer, Nick Vinay. They met as teenagers and remained close friends until Darin's death in 1973 at the age of 37. Vinay died of cancer in 1998 at the age of 61. When we left off, Vinay was talking about the years they worked in the Brill Building in New York City, trying to make it in the music business. Terry asked Vinay what aspirations Bobby Darin had for his career.
Darin always wanted to be nothing other than a songwriter and sometimes performer. And songwriting was his main goal at that time. I think that's because being a star or a hit artist probably was too much of a fantasy. Sometimes you have a dream that's too heavy to carry. But being a songwriter was more realistic, and he wanted to be a songwriter. That was very important to him.
How much faith did he have in his singing?
He had more faith in his songwriting than his singing, but as the first couple records he made, of course, you know, did not sell very well. They were bombs. But as he progressed, he felt stronger about his singing, and at some point he decided that he's going to have to do it with his songs because he just felt that he had the interpretation he couldn't give to other people when he just wrote them.
Although he started off with rock and roll hits, he seemed to know early on that he wanted to sing standards and probably end up in Vegas. Now, a lot of rock and rollers in the late 50s and early 60s were groomed to play Vegas, but often against their will. But the feeling was rock and roll is a fad, and unless you learn how to play Vegas, you'll be out of a career by the time you're in your 20s.
Well, you're correct.
Go ahead.
That particular time period, you know, we were still coming out of the late 40s. The influence in the 50s was from the adults in the late 40s. And singing was legit singing, and you had to play in a club, and you had to play Vegas and those venues, or you weren't a success. And if you didn't learn to play those places, you would end up doing one-nighters with 20 other acts that had one hit on various disc jockey shows in small towns. And a lot of the rock and rollers could not do the pop situation, and a lot of them could. And the transition was tough for some. There was Paul Anka who made the transition, and there was very few of them, really. And Darin made the great transition.
For a lot of people in rock and roll, listeners and performers, Vegas symbolized everything that was square and unsavory about show business. Why did Bobby Darin want that?
Well, Darin thought that he could actually bridge the gap and bring his audience, and the word teenagers is the word they use, people under the age of 25, he could actually bring them up to where they too would appreciate Sinatra, they'd appreciate Tony Bennett, they'd appreciate pop music, and he tried to cross it. He tried to keep the rhythm and the tempo for dancing situations and for the excitement. And later on, when you get into Mac the Knife, you'll see he did it.
Well, we should hear Mac the Knife. Now, he recorded this when he was 23.
23.
And I know when I heard it when I was young, it was catchy. I don't know. And then in college, I was introduced to the three-penny opera, and I thought, boy, that Bobby Darin, he really ruined Mac the Knife. He made it into a showbiz anthem. How horrible of him. And when I listen to it now, I think, what a great recording. What incredible rhythm he has in this. I mean, he transforms the song, but yes. He does something really interesting with it.
And I must tell you, that's his concept. It was his idea, and everyone thought he had lost it.
That he was crazy?
He was crazy. They thought they just couldn't believe that he was going to do that, and he did.
Well, why did he choose this song? What did he hear in it? What did he hear in it to swing it? I mean, it's not a song that you think of swinging.
Well, we're dealing with a guy that could go back to the 20s. He knew Frank Tashmatter and Johnny Dodds and the early Dixieland musicians. He was steeped in the music business history and various forms of music. And he loved, personally, Dixieland. Had he had his druthers, born 20 years earlier, he would have been a Dixieland. He would have had a Dixieland band. And what he did is he loved these tunes, Kurt Weill tunes. He just loved them because they were German umpa tunes, you know. They were kind of done in that old style for the show, of course. And he just loved the whole theory, the way the song was written, the mysterious lyrics, their various levels. He thought he could get away with it, and he did. He was just brilliant.
Well, let's hear Mac the Knife is recorded by Bobby Darin in late 1958.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag's just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10, old Mackey's back in town. Now you hear about Louis Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie Heath spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Jenny Diver, ho, ho, yeah, Sugi Tawdry, ooh, Miss Lottie Lenya, and old Lucy Brown. Now that Maggie's back in town, I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Suki Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Not that Maggie's back in.
Mack the Knife, recorded in 1958. We're listening to a 1996 interview with the late Nick Vinay, who was Bobby Darin's close friend and producer. The movie about Darin, Beyond the Sea, opens December 29th. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation about Bobby Darin with Darin's close friend and producer, Nick Vinay. It was recorded in 1996, 2 years before Vinay's death. Vinay had just co-produced a Bobby Darin box set.
Though he was supposed to record Donkashane after
Yes,
Mack
he was.
The Knife. But instead, he gave the song to Wayne Newton, and of course, the rest is history.
Darin was producing Wayne. Darin had signed Wayne Newton. Wayne was brought to Bobby by Dick Clark, believe it or not, in New York. And we went down to see him playing in a lounge, and he was just terrific. And Bobby signed him as his first act on his Capitol production deal. Bobby was banking for the future. He wanted to produce, and he wanted to publish, and he wanted to run a record company and slowly over the years taper off from performing, which at that time was becoming more difficult for him physically. And he just didn't want to make it public, so he started getting more involved in production. As you know, Darin didn't have a lot of years.
Well, I'm going to skip playing Wayne Newton's Donkashane because I want to save as much time as we can to play Bobby Darin's
you.
Music.
Cut that part out, but I don't blame you.
So how did Bobby Darin actually make it to Vegas?
Well, Steve Blauner, his manager, introduced him to George Burns. And George Burns just, you got to understand, Darin, when he walked in the room, he had that presence, that great spirit. Very few people have it, but when they have it, you know it. They walk in a room and everybody stops. They may not be facing the door, but they stop. And George Burns met Darin, and he just felt that thing that Darin had, that this kid is going to be a star. And Darin had already had a couple of records on the charts. And Blauner told Burns that if you take him to Vegas, you won't be disappointed. And he did. And Darin just lit up Vegas. You know, he was one of the highest paid performers ever in his 20s in Las Vegas.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he packed it in. Darin was truly a phenomenon in Las Vegas. It was unbelievable.
Were you in Vegas, too, at that time?
Oh, we used to go up there all the time. Remember, we're two kids, two poor kids from the city. I'm from Baltimore, and he's from New York. And this was dog heaven for us. We were raised that you're successful. You drive Cadillacs. You wear a gold link bracelet on your left hand to tell you who you are. And you wear one on your right hand to tell you who you were. And we did it all. We were foolish like that, but it was worth it. And Vegas to us was just the cat's meow, I can't tell you. We didn't even think it was gaudy. We thought it was neat. We were in our 20s, you know. And it was very exciting because we came from very good people, but very simple neighborhoods.
Well, you know, in his Vegas period, he recorded a lot of jazz standards. And I want to play one of my favorites, which you happen to co-produce. And it's A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. I think this is a wonderful recording and shows how good his jazz singing is. You were at the session. You co-produced it. Why don't you tell
yes,
us a little
bit
about it?
Darin had a great ear and a great respect for other writers. A lot of writers do not listen to other writers, nor do they care about other writers' works. And a lot of artists who write don't listen to other writers or their works. Darin had one of those great feelings about other talent. And he was just always just excited about great writers and a lot of writers and a lot of the great songs. And this particular song is one that he felt he could never, ever write a song like this. And the next best thing would be to sing it. He loved it so much, and he did.
So this was recorded in 1962, and Billy May is the arranger and conductor on this, and of course he did a lot of work with Frank Sinatra and many other singers as well. So why don't we hear A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square?
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darn world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with...
Did Vegas change Bobby Darin's personality, and did success change him?
Success never changed Darin. Vegas never changed Darin. Politics changed Darin. That's what changed Bobby Darin. His political awareness and growth, and his involvement in politics. He went from being a kid raised in the center to a kid that practically became a bomb-throwing leftist politically. And meeting the Kennedys also altered his life. And it altered his ability to play Vegas under certain conditions. Number one, he wanted Vegas to integrate more. He wanted to see more black Americans working at the tables, working in the orchestras, working at the various other jobs, other than the jobs where you didn't see anyone, those faceless jobs in the back. And he became a civil rights worker, quietly.
Did this political awakening lead to the folk part of his career?
Yes. He wanted to stay with the audience that started with him, and he wanted to make the transition with them. For instance, it was okay for you and I to, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you were there. He wanted, if I could take and start wearing Levi's and letting my hair grow long, and started campaigning for Kennedy. He thought he could do that too, and he didn't understand why people would say he's trying to become a folky. They didn't say Dylan's trying to become a folky. It didn't say I was becoming a folk producer.
But they thought it was phony that somebody with a Vegas pedigree at this point was growing their hair long and singing folk songs.
And it's an interesting thing. He was willing to lose half his audience for his political conviction. But there was a point there when he lost almost all his audience because one group didn't like him going that far to the left, and the other group on the left didn't want him coming over because they didn't trust him. He was in between a rock and a hard place.
Let me actually play one of his folk songs, one of the songs that he wrote and that he used to close his show with, and it's called Simple Song of Freedom. Now, we're going to hear a demo version of it, I believe previously unreleased, that's featured on this box set. And you were there when he recorded the demo. In fact, I think the tape machine was on your lap.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Darin had been working on the song. And what he wanted to write was This Land Is Your Land. He wanted to write a song that people could take with them, they could sing with them. And he worked very hard to simplify this. And it's a statement of the time. I get very emotional when I think of it. But he finished it that morning, and he put it on the tape recorder. I held the tape recorder on my lap and held the mic up. And that was the final version. In fact, there's a mistake in it, but he kept going. And he said, "That's my anthem." And he closed his shows forever after that with that song.
Why don't we pause here and listen to Bobby Darin's demo of his song, Simple Song of Freedom.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere that we the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I won't dig your diamonds or hunt your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. So come and sing a simple song of freedom.
You know, this the song that we heard the demo of, Simple Song of Freedom, his actual studio version of that wasn't released until after his death.
Yes, yes.
And there's, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that there were a lot of things on tape that weren't released during his lifetime. He just felt sometimes he wasn't ready to release it, and he had so much he wanted to do, he was afraid to release a lot of things. It might hurt his schedule. And he was a man racing against time, I promise you.
We're listening to Terry's 1996 interview with the late Nick Vinay, who was Bobby Darin's close friend and producer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bobby Darin's close friend and producer, Nick Vinay. It was recorded in 1996, 2 years before Vinay's death. When they spoke, Vinay had just co-produced a Bobby Darin box set. Beyond the Sea, the film about Bobby Darin, starring Kevin Spacey, opens December 29th.
He died of a heart condition. How long was he aware that he had a heart condition? Did he always know that?
Yes, he did. He knew that from when he was a small kid, when he was in his when he was 8 or 9 years old, he understood that. He also understood he wasn't going to make it to 21. And then the new diagnosis said 30. We're the exact age, and he passed away at 36, 37. He outlived the sentences they gave him of how long he was going to live. But he also knew that he had pressed his luck. We did a lot of gambling. We loved Las Vegas. And he used to say, I'm playing it like it lays. Towards the end there, he used to say, boy, I'm pressing my luck, but I'm going to double up. And that was his phrase all the time. He said, we'll go in the studio. I'm going to double up and see if I can do an album while I still have the energy. He was wearing down towards the end.
You co-produced the new box set of Bobby Darin's work, which is divided into his rock work, his pop work, and his folk and country. What was it like for you to sit down and listen back to all of this?
It was tough. It was tough. The mistakes were bigger. The best parts were better. And it's always tough going back. Darin, we shared a lot of philosophy. I know that Darin never grew old, not because he died young. If he was alive today, he still would not be old. Darin was not an old person. He was young. He would have been young now. And going back over these things, you see the amount of time and years and the places. It's very difficult to do a box set. I've worked with other box sets on people I've worked with, but this one was the toughest because we had put so much time and space between all the songs. We were everywhere: New York, Nashville, Chicago, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami. It was one of those times when this country was on the move. TV was not the king that it is today. There was more entertainment out there.
I'd like to close with a song, and I'm going to let you pick this one. I'd like you to pick and to introduce a song that you particularly love or that has special significance for you.
I'd like to play Beyond the Sea.
And why do you want to choose this?
Darren would go up to Pfeiffer Beach all the time in Big Sur. And that's where he did his best thinking towards the end. And he would whistle Beyond the Sea on the beach. And I'd walk, a quarter of a mile behind him, because he wanted me to see how the sound sounded when the wind brought it back. He was still planning on recording a new version of Beyond the Sea at Pfeiffer Beach. It just means a lot.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt. Beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Bobby Darin recorded on Christmas Eve, 1958, 46 years ago today. Our interview with the late Nick Vinay was recorded in 1996. The film about Darin, Beyond the Sea, hits theaters around the country next week. Our show was produced today by Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Ian Chellog, and Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Happy holidays from all of us at Fresh Air. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
I know.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been a tough year, but we're determined to end it with some of the people who helped us laugh. On the next Fresh Air, we begin a week of our most entertaining interviews of the year, starting with Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman, and Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob and many other animated characters. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.